This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress, a one-person business based in Philadelphia. And I ask you, what caving-related business is not a one-person business, right? There's so few of us. And when there's too many cooks in the kitchen, man, that's when you get problems. But back to Sophie. She started making leggings as sort of an expert with the sewing machine, and she expanded from there over the years, and then she started caving, and she was looking for cave suits. There's a few out there, but there's not a lot to choose from. And so she thought, well, I could do better than that, and maybe I could make mine look even cooler. And she sure does. Her cave suits are made from the right stuff, too. 500 denier Cordura, twice as thick where it counts, and they come in a lot of colors. She'll make you a basic suit, and she'll do some add-ons, too, if you want. Extra pockets, inside pockets. The knee pad pockets are cool. An extra bat stencil, wherever you want it. Everything's made to order just for you. And you can order yours at SophieReaptress.com. My wife loves her Sophie suit. SophieReaptress.com, or you can find her on Instagram at SophieReaptress. She's the one with like 30-plus thousand followers. You can't miss her. Get a nice cave suit from Sophie Reaptress. There's a link in the description of this podcast. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, the NSS, based in Huntsville, Alabama. But you'll find local chapters all over the country. You can find yours through the NSS website, caves.org, and I've got a link in the description of this podcast. But the reason you want to get involved with the local grotto is, like a lot of things, caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Quite the opposite if you do. And how do you get to know what to do? Well, you hang out with cavers. They'll take you. We like making friends. And indeed, we wouldn't want you to go unless you were going with somebody who knew what they were doing. So get in touch with your local grotto. You don't have to join or anything right away. You know, if you want to just give it a try and see if it's something that you want to do, you can do that too. We're pretty laid back, us cavers. So click that link in the description of this podcast, find your local grotto, and ease your way into it. My apologies to anyone who has tried to get a hold of me about this podcast over the last few months. I have been just the worst as far as responding to things. The Caving Podcast is just kind of, it's something that I kind of just handle once a month. If I get an interview, I'll do that. And then there's the edit. And the rest of the month, I just have this terrible, terrible habit. And it's not just podcast related. It's everything in my life. And I just need to be better about it. I just have this terrible habit of ignoring emails. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I'll respond and be like, yeah, sorry. The most common thing that I do is apologize at the top of the email for having not responded in a timely manner. It's just who I am. And I'm not saying that that's an excuse. It's not. I'm not a fan of being that person. But I really do care about this podcast, and I care that you have emailed me about it. And so I really do appreciate your patience where that's concerned. I did get an email from the people behind Cave Week 2024, which this year is the week of June 2nd. It's a week to celebrate our national park caves. More than 20 U.S. parks participate, and lots of Canadian sites as well, plus NASA participating in Cave Week this year. And I've got a link to the Cave Week page in the description of this podcast as well. So I just covered all three links that are in there in the first few minutes of the podcast. So this is the 7th anniversary of Cave Week, which is pretty sweet. And they're just great resources at that link on how you can participate and celebrate Cave Week 2024. And I'm hoping to have some guests to do some short segments and some episodes between now and June to talk about Cave Week. So this being March, just putting it on your radar, Cave Week, June 2nd through the 8th for 2024. All right. This particular episode was so much fun. I got to talk with Dave Broombaugh out in California, but he's been all over. He's worked back home in Pennsylvania. He's worked Caverns of Sonora. He's worked at Carlsbad Caverns, but currently he is out in Yosemite. Tough gig. but he's Caver Dave. He is Caver Dave. And I've seen his name, you know, in the NSS news. I've seen him, you know, on social media. I follow him on Instagram as well. Seeing him and his family doing all this caving related stuff and all these pictures that he posts, It was so cool to finally talk to him. And as you'll hear, he was just super affable and so approachable. I was so glad to have gotten the chance to talk to him. Thank you to Matt Bowers for connecting me with Dave. Matt's such a cheerleader for this podcast. He's one of those people that I, you know, I'll get a Facebook message or something and I'll just ignore it for 2 weeks and then finally write him back. I'm sorry, Matt. Dave Broombaugh, this was so much fun. Oh, and don't miss the talk toward the end about when he helped the FBI locate some unexploded ordnances in a cave on national park property. That's a great story. Here's me and Dave Broombaugh. Okay, Dave, we're going to start with a question that is unrelated to caving and is pretty selfish. You're at Yosemite National Park. What is the best time of year to visit and avoid the crowds? I'm sure you get that question all the time.
Early spring is super exciting to me because we just had the snow melt. So it is kind of one of the treacherous times of year to come with the rivers being raging. But as long as you're not trying to go swimming in the river. Yeah, I'd say early spring. The waterfalls are pumping and school hasn't let out. That's my favorite time of year in Yosemite.
All right. Early spring then. Noted. All right. I'm just trying to plan my visit. I've never been, and I don't want to go in the middle of summer, you know.
Oh, definitely do not come in the summer. The waterfalls start to dry up. There's like sometimes like a 3-hour line just at the entrance gate to get in.
Jeez.
And the fires. Sometimes Yosemite Valley is just bogged down with smoke for like a month on end.
Goodness.
But we got a spare room if you're ever coming out.
All right. All right. Well, careful. Know. Careful who you offer that to because I might hold you to it.
Yeah. You know, the caving community.
Well, that's true. That's true. Cavers are generous, aren't they? Well, Dave, man, thanks for coming on and talking. You've been in the caving world your whole life, it seems like, starting the generation before you. Your dad was or is a guide in Pennsylvania?
He is.
Still.
In fact, his mother as well. So, yeah, third generation cave guide. Yeah, Yosemite is actually my first job that wasn't cave focused. So I like it. Yosemite is obviously awesome, but I feel really out of my realm, not being underground every day. That's different for me. But yeah, Penn's Cave is pretty much the cave I grew up in. It's in central Pennsylvania. And dad started working there when he was, I think, 19 or 20. And he thought it would just be a summer gig. And he got bit by the cave bug. And here we are about 4 decades later.
Wow.
He's probably in that cave right now. It's a boat cave. So that's one of the really neat things about Penn's Cave. You drive like a barge style boat that's like 25 feet long and they load up like almost 20 tourists on it and take them through that. It's a beautiful cave, especially pretty decent sized rooms for Pennsylvania. I can picture every corner of that cave just by closing my eyes. I've been through it so many times.
Are there pictures on your Instagram feed? I feel like I've seen some pictures of maybe you and the family in a boat in a cave. Is that that cave?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure you did see that photo. Most of my Instagram is Carlsbad just because, you know, there's so much to photograph there. And I was there for about 5-6 years. Our daughter, Rose, since that's a boat cave, you know, it's pretty easy to take people that can't walk through it. So when she was 10 days old, we took her through that cave. And she was only there in Pennsylvania for the first year and a half of her life, but she's been through it probably 30 times at least.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, cool. So you then took a job there in 02, it seems. But
yeah.
I mean, caving was part of your life before 02, right?
Oh, yeah. Dad, you know, would take me and my brothers caving. It'd be our father-son bonding. And then I would often just, you know, fake sick from school so I could just hop on the back of that cave boat and just ride through Penn's Cave all day instead of going to school. But Dad would take us caving all the time. So it started as, you know, it was a passion, a hobby. And I'm like, this will be a great job through college. And then I became a teacher and I was teaching 5th grade. And so it was my summer job. I was always craving to get back in the cave, though. I'm like, the cave is my classroom. So I really didn't teach for all that long. But then we decided to travel around and use caves as our excuse for traveling around. So my wife and I moved at the time, you know, my long-term girlfriend at the time, Melissa, we moved to Canada because there's amazing caves on Vancouver Island. So Melissa was going to film school in Vancouver, and I started working at a cave park on Vancouver Island called Horn Lake Cave Park, and spent a couple of years there. That place is a trip. It's an amazing, amazing place.
So when did you first start caving then? And I'm kind of asking this for selfish reasons too, because I've got two boys and my youngest seems to enjoy caving from the few times that we've gone, but I'm trying to instill a love of the sport and, you know, really just being outside and stuff like that. When did you first start going and did the bug bite you right away?
Yeah, Dad was taking us since we could walk into caves. Well, before that, because of the boat trips, and all the other tourist caves, the show caves. Pennsylvania has, at the moment, it's 7 show caves. There's 1,200 roughly caves in Pennsylvania. And there used to be 17 show caves in Pennsylvania. It's just a tricky business to keep up with. But there's also some, you know, great just beginner caves everywhere you go, obviously. But where we grew up was a nice NSS cave preserve. Tituna Cave is there. So that's one that I learned to just get comfortable with being on ground with. That's the one that my daughter started whenever she was just learning how to walk. We have some video footage of her like taking her first steps underground in Tituna Cave. Yeah, if anyone doesn't know of that cave preserve, Tyrone, Pennsylvania and Altoona, Pennsylvania have a nice cave between the two. So Tituna.
Oh, there you go.
NSS Cave Preserve. They tried to commercialize that one a few times, but it's prone to flooding. So yeah, that's always the cave that I would end up taking like Boy Scout groups to, and any beginner cavers, I'd do a trip to Tituna with them.
Back to Penn's cave. Wait a second. The Nittany Lion of Penn State, the weirdest high profile mascot there is, it came from Penn's cave or something?
Yeah, it indeed did. And even a lot of college students that go to Penn State don't know that. A lot of them think it's like, some of them think it's an actual like species of cat, or it's a localized nickname of cat, Nittany, which comes from Nittany. So there's a legend about the cave, and this legend was written down by Henry Shoemaker. Shoemaker was a Pennsylvania historian. He would meet with the last of the Native American elders in the area, and he'd write down their stories. And some of his stories are pretty far stretched. There's a whole book just about Penn's Cave with legends about that one cave. And one even has like a story of a headless horseman in it. So they get pretty wild. But yeah, the most famous one is just called The Legend of Penn's Cave. And so the story goes that Princess Nittany, she was the daughter of Chief Okecho from the Seneca tribe of that area. And they lived around that cave. And she was down by a creek washing a deerskin one day when a Frenchman wandered along, Malachi Boye. And so they started talking and they fell in love and ran away to be together forever. Well, her father, Chief Okecho, discovered they were gone and gathered his 7 sons, and they went searching for their little sister, and took a couple of days, 3 days, they say, they found them. They waited till nightfall, and then they attacked. And Malachi put up a fight, and he killed 2 of the brothers, injured 2 others, but he was no match for all 7, and they dragged him back to the cave and thrust him in. So he was searching for a way out because the brothers were guarding the main entrance. And then finally, supposedly after 3 days of swimming through the 38 degree Fahrenheit water. That's one thing I love about that cave. It's 52 degree air temperature, but always 38 degree water temperature. There's these giant rainbow trout in there too. Like,
oh gosh,
warm, but I'm getting sidetracked. So Malachi finally went to the deepest, darkest depths of the cave and breathed his last. And some say that on a quiet spring night, you can still hear him in the cave searching for his long lost love, yelling, Nittany. That is the legend of Penn's Cave. So Nittany Mountain is supposedly named for Princess Nittany, Nittany Mountain. And it's a lone mountain. And then above it, sort of watching over it on the outskirts of Penn State area, State College, there's seven mountains. So the seven mountains represent the seven older brothers overlooking Mount Nittany.
Okay. It all ties together. Wow. All right. All right. So in show cave world, lighting is a subject of, well, great importance, but also sometimes a subject of ridicule among cavers. They'll visit, you know, I hear about cavers visiting show caves and being like, the lights were terrible. They were all different colors and things like that. But you've got some experience lighting caves or some thoughts on lighting caves?
Yeah, I did two stints of employment at Penn's Cave. One when I was like in college, and then we went away and we worked at other caves. I mentioned the Canadian one. We went to Texas. Then we made our way back to Penn's Cave, and I was the cave manager at the time. They assigned me as cave manager.
That sounds important.
And I enjoyed the job of cave manager. So I oversaw the lighting of the cave. And, you know, I had read up on all different techniques that various cavers use and different caving companies. Yeah, we got in touch with Roy Davis, who, you know, formerly of Cumberland Caverns, rest his soul. And we got Roy to come up to Pennsylvania to help redesign the lights in, like, the main chamber of the cave called the dry room.
All right.
It's the largest chamber in that cave.
What were the lights like before you got a hold of it then?
They were hot and they were not always put in the right spot. Like, you know, Penn's Cave it's a family business. It's been in their same family for over 100 years. Not my family. My family has worked for that family for decades, but it's also a farming family. They have a wildlife park with like bison and elk and mountain lions and wolves. And I was not part of that side of the business, but you know, they had a lot of farm hands that helped out with stuff, and they were pretty good with moving around through the cave with cave guides and the cave supervisor supervising that process. But if a light was not exactly where it should be, and like a cold blacktite would drip out on one of those hot bulbs, it would just explode, and you'd hear it like shotgun through the cave. So not always ideal. And there were times where, you know, the lights were blinding in, hitting your face. They tried to hide them, but if it ever got off angle wise, which was when you're driving the boat through the cave, sometimes if that light hits you right in the eye, you got to see where you're going. And there's sections where there's boulders under the water that you just have to know where they're at and line the boat up just right. If there was a warm rain, the whole cave would fill up with fog. You couldn't really see out in front of you. So you had to memorize like the cracks in the ceiling and line up the boat with that as you're going down through the cave. But yeah, I knew that Roy was like, I believe in his 80s at the time. We got a hold of him and he said that he'd be interested in doing another cave lighting project. So he came up and he had his RV camper and he camped on site. He was there for a couple of weeks. And I was pretty much his like Sherpa. Like he would go with me in the boat. And he'd sit in the boat and we were starting to put in, you know, LED lights. So he would instruct me on installation and the way he wanted them angled. But he kept chomping at the bit to get off the boat and get up in the cave. He's a legendary caver, phenomenal caver. But I was just terrified that he was going to fall in some of those areas because he kept wanting to walk up into the rooms and not crawl as I was going up through. So I rigged up all these ropes, these hand lines, the whole way through the chamber and put ascenders and prussics on them so that he had something to grip to as he's going up there. And I'll never forget, we got up into the dry room and we sat down on this big boulder right after adjusting some lights. And he just started telling me all these stories of all the different caves he's lit. You know, he's lit like 200 caves across the world.
Wow.
And so it was just an honor to be around him and chatting with him in the cave and helping him with, he said, this is my final project. I'm not going to do any others. And sure enough, it was like about a year later that Roy passed on. So yeah, that was a memorable time for me there.
Well, that's really special. You were his last cave and his last consultee, I guess.
It was humbling to be with him.
Were you, I mean, I guess if you were heading it up, you ended up being pretty satisfied with the work that was done?
Yes. He highlighted features, sort of like a museum formation. There's one centralized stalagmite in that room that's typically known as the Buddha stalagmite. And, you know, all the guides there will give a bunch of different names to it. It looks like Jabba the Hutt if you add the tail at the end. And so he like really highlighted that one, doing like this from the bottom lighting to make it dramatic. And then there's a Nittany Lion stalagmite in that same room, a huge head that looks like the Nittany Lion head. And it's pretty big. It's like literally the size of like the statues you see in Penn State University. So we did some dramatic side lighting of that. It was artistic.
So let's go back to, I know we're kind of jumping around the timeline. Let's go back to Canada. You were like a guide.
Yes. But the guiding that they offer there at Horn Lake Cave Park is adventure guiding. It's real deal caving.
So you're caving.
Yeah, crawling, climbing, and then if they signed up for the good experience, then rappelling. There's a series of waterfalls in their main cave called Riverbend Cave. There's one tour that goes almost all the way to the bottom, rappelling down some little waterfalls. And then there's their biggest tour, which pretty much if you sign up for that, it's like a full day commitment. In fact, depending on their rope background, you sort of got to do like an interview with the folks to find out their background. There's a mandatory rappel experience before going to the cave.
I would imagine.
Like taking them up onto a little 50-foot cliff early in the morning and just doing some rappelling with them, getting to know them, and then full day cave tour. And then you get to the Rain Barrel, which is a nearly 80-foot waterfall that the visitors get to rappel down, and you're belaying them as they rappel down. So yeah, well, I was doing that every day. It was pretty magical. But then when you rappel down the Rain Barrel, you get to the China Shop, which is like this gloriously decorated part of the cave. Gorgeous calcite in pristine condition at the bottom. But then you get to the terminal sump, where water is just going down this tunnel that's full of gravel. And I started there shortly after college, and a buddy of mine started there at the same time. His name was Miles Fulmer. He was a Canadian rock climber, and he wasn't a caver prior to that. And that was one of the neat things about working there, is all the people you'd get to meet. Guides from all over the world go there to work. I had a buddy from Australia that was working there. We had the same birthday to the hour. It was crazy. His name is Shane Bryce Girdle. He's an Australian rock climber and caver. And I always called him Willy Wonka because his family runs a chocolate factory over in Australia. Paul Blood was a Yorkshire caver that came to that park, and he was like managing it for a while. So he taught me loads about rope rescue. And speaking of rope rescue, Phil Whitfield, it was an honor to get to know Phil. He taught British Columbia Cave Rescue, and I learned a lot from Phil and got to help him with some cave gating projects. Yeah, that was definitely one of the highlights of Canada for me. But Miles started working there with me in 2012. And then he's just been there ever since. And it's a provincial park, so it's government, but the government's like, we got these amazing caves, but we want other people to run them for us. So they contract it to a company to run the park for them. And just about 2 years ago, Miles got like family to pitch in and got some loans and took over the company. So he's now like running Horn Lake Cave Park. And he was always a real motivated guy for exploration and whatnot. Like there's sections and caves named like the Miles High area because he climbed them. And he led a dig just recently. They started a few months ago in Riverbend Cave there at the terminal sump. And at the bottom of the mountain is Lower Cave, where water's coming out of it. And we knew that they were hydraulically connected because they've done dye testing and it would pop up from Riverbend down into Lower. But there were always two separate caves. And we would lead just like little scrambling adventure tours into Lower Cave. But a few months ago, Miles led a dig trip expedition and made the connection. And now Riverbend Cave and Lower Cave are actually one cave. I don't know if they're ever going to incorporate that in the commercialization aspect of it. But yeah, that's a special cave park. They've got a lot of caves in there. And some of them are like, there's one cave that's like, in my view, it's the sort of the Lechuguilla of Canada. It's supposedly Canada's most decorated cave, and it's protected. So it's like the cave not to be spoken of because people try to find it and break into it. So yeah, they have more than just what they advertise, of course.
I'm sorry, you interrupted a bear, a sleeping bear in a cave?
So in the winter, there weren't many people working there. It was just me and Paul, and we usually like took turns working. And we would have a little bit of overlap where we'd see each other, but then we would just be alone out at that cave park in the wilderness waiting for people to come go caving. So in that little bit of overlap chunk, we'd go ridge walking and, you know, practice some rope stuff and do a little caving. And so we were ridge walking one day and we found this decent sinkhole depression cave entrance. And it wasn't listed on the cave survey map of the area.
So uh-huh.
We're like, this might be a new one. We suspected potential animal den, as you would for cave entrances that are easy to climb into, just scrambling down the sinkhole and then pop into the hole. And it was just like a 5-foot drop with easy climbs. But there was no scratch marks. There was no signs, in my opinion, of anything going in or out. And there was no smell. So I climbed down in, and I don't have the best of vision. I've had like a dozen eye surgeries in my life, and I'm actually looking at you through man-made objects that are surgically implanted in these eyeballs now.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, some people say that's why I'm meant to be a caver, because they say I'm blind as a bat, even but I hate that because bats see just fine. But anyways, I get down in the cave, and I see a dark tunnel, and I start crawling towards it. And Paul's up top and he's yelling, "Hey, Dave, does it go anywhere?" And I'm all like, "Give me a moment." And I start going towards this dark tunnel to see if the dark tunnel goes.
Oh, no.
But then I realized that the dark tunnel was reflecting my light back at me, and that it indeed was not a dark tunnel. It was just dark fur that was only about like 4 feet away from me.
Oh, my God.
So I start just quietly crawling backwards. And Paul's like, "Does it go anywhere, Dave?" And I look up at him. I'm like, "Shh, we gotta leave." And I climb up out. And then Paul's like, "Why? What's going on?" I'm like, "Let's go. There's a bear down there." And I'm like, "Yeah, there's a bear down there. Let's go." Paul was my superior at the park. He was my supervisor and legendary caver from Yorkshire. And he's like, "I used to work with bears back in the UK. I've never actually like witnessed one hibernating in a cave. Maybe I'll just take a quick peek." I'm like, "I don't think that's a good idea, Paul. I think we should just leave." And he's like, "Oh, it'll be fine. I'll just take a quiet, quick peek." And he scrambles down and I see him look in the direction I pointed and his eyes get real wide. And then he quickly scrambles back up and he says, "She's awake now." And we left the area.
She's awake.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun one. It turned out pretty well, and it could have not turned out pretty well.
Yeah. Woo. Very scary indeed. All right. So you mentioned the cave in Texas earlier. Let's cover that time. And you're talking about a cave that's been talked about on this podcast a lot, Caverns of Sonora.
Yeah. It was actually getting real hard to renew my Canadian work permit. I had to go through this big process every year. And so after a few years of that, we're like, let's head somewhere else. And so, you know, the Gurney Guide to American Show Caves, the Gurney Guide is was always pretty much like our travel book. We'd use it to travel around, and we would also use it for like work ideas. We'd just flip through the Gurney Guide and be all like, let's give them a call. So we're up in Canada and we were flipping through the Gurney Guide, and we got to that beautiful crystal butterfly picture of the Caverns of Sonora. And we're like, let's give them a call. I've always heard that cave is amazing. So we called them up, wonderful family, the Mayfields, ranching family. And they're like, we're cavers and we're looking for a place to work. And they're like, come on down. We'll see how it goes. You can join us for Thanksgiving. So we went down and joined them for Thanksgiving. And they're like, you can start working today. And then it turned out that that meant that we were like doing all the cleanup work for Thanksgiving and whatnot. Fun. They actually host like a Thanksgiving that anyone's allowed to go to. I'm pretty sure they still do it, but like anyone from the public can just go to Thanksgiving.
Wow.
With the owners of the Caverns of Sonora.
Huh.
So as you probably know, that cave is something special. The first 10 minutes of it was Mayfield Cave back in the day. And then cavers crossed that treacherous pit to find the first pretty part. And from then on out is just mile after mile of crystal formation, where just every room, ceiling, wall, and floor, immaculate crystal integrity, and very incredibly rare speleothems. Like there's millions of helictites. Like there's rooms that you enter and that just looks like crystal porcupines everywhere.
Wow.
Besides the millions of helictites, you know, it has beaded helictites. It has split capillary helictites. So, you know, that's where the hole that the water, because, you know, helictites grow from pressurized solution coming out of the wall, then grow in any direction, and they get their name helictite from the root word of helix, because they can spiral. So they do have, you know, figure eight helictites coming out of the walls in some areas. But if the capillary is like split and water comes out two directions, it makes like V-shaped helictites. So it looks like two, but they're coming from the same source. So it's one speleothem. And they have slit capillary helictites. So if the capillary is slit, the water fans out, and then they're commonly called, you know, fishtail helictites. Huh. Those are really rare, but there's a bunch of fishtail helictites in the Caverns of Sonora. My wife, phenomenal photographer, and her cave photography really took off there. I'm looking on my wall to see if I have that one picture. She has a picture of a fishtail helictite that's just like glass that you can see almost right through it. But then, of course, the famous butterfly formation is not just famous because it looks like a nice crystal butterfly. It's famous because it's a split slit capillary helictite. So it's the only formation known to have grown in that unique manner ever found anywhere in the world. So we spent more time in that cave probably on our days off than the days we were working, because we were just down there taking thousands of photos and just reveling in the majesty of that. It's a hot cave, though. It's like a sauna. You're
sweating. Is it really?
Yeah.
So you then, as an employee, had exclusive access to the cave, and whenever, more or less whenever you wanted, you'd go in and take pictures and stuff?
Yeah, but we were shift leaders. We lived on site, so we would watch over the campground at night, and, you know, we'd open up the gift shop in the morning and close it up at the end of the day. So not management, but we were like super shift leaders. So, yeah, they trusted us. In fact, that's where I got to meet George Vinny, because they trust him, of course. George, as many of you, I'm sure, know, you know, he ran the National Cave and Karst Research Institute for years. He was the president of the International Union of Speleology. And I was guiding a tour of visitors through the cave, and suddenly I just come across a man sitting in a lawn chair in the cave, just like looking at the ceiling. And I recognized him right away. And so I'm like, well, folks, this is Dr. George Vinny. He's the director of the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, one of the most famous cave researchers in the world. And they're like, oh, and they're taking pictures of him. And then we move on. So that's where I first met George. And it turns out George was actually a caving buddy of my dad back in the 80s because George went to Penn State University. I have a few stories like that from other various cavers too. But yeah, we spent a lot of time in that cave. In fact, you might have one of Melissa's photos if you've been with the NSS for a while, which I'm sure you have been, because one of her Sonora shots was a cover shot for a 2014 issue of the NSS. It was a conservation issue. I think it was like April of 2014. She got a picture of a crystalline stalactite, and you can see a human hair coming out of the crystal.
Oh, man. Okay.
So, yeah, that's the cave that really made Melissa's cave photography take off.
All right. So specifically about that, was the focus then on visitation? Like, hey, look, a human hair ended up on this speleothem and we need to, I guess, tread more lightly or something like that, or what?
The theme was that, you know, there's no such thing as zero impact caving.
Yeah, okay.
The goal is minimal impact caving. There was a newspaper article that featured her. If you Google her name and whatnot, Melissa Horn, cave photography, you find a couple newspaper articles where she's talking about that. I love that newspaper article because our daughter will be able to look back on it because she talked about our second date when I first took her caving, and that's when she got into caving. She had never been caving before, and I took Melissa to Coombscat Cave, this little hole-in-the-wall cave in Pennsylvania. So I just like that one of our first dates has a newspaper article written about it. But yeah, you know, no such thing as no impact caving, hence all the lint that they clean out of all the show caves. And Carlsbad Caverns, if I recall correctly, I've been here at Yosemite for about 2 years now. I want to say 400 pounds of lint has been cleaned out of that cave.
Oh,
thus
my gosh.
I would help with leading lint cleaning trips. And yeah, you go through the black light, you know, you can just see efflorescing in your black light as you make your way through the cave. The average human sheds 1 million dead skin cells per hour. So on the average cave tour, you know, through Sonora, they'll take like 10 people and they'll have a guide in the front and a guide in the back to try to watch it. The guide in the back, if it's a big group, they'll have a guide in the back. And the guy in the back is watching to make sure that no one's touching anything. But just by taking 10 people through an hour tour, that's 10 million dead skin cells shed in the cave. And not to mention your hair and your clothing fabric.
So you were part of some of those cleanups. And we've talked about lint cleanup on the podcast before. And it was a kind of a concept that was new to me because, you know, I'm the Midwest. Our caves are wet. I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong, but it doesn't seem like that's as much of a problem here as opposed to the drier caves out west.
With the epigenic caves, like in Indiana and Pennsylvania and lots of other places, of course, but in the epigenic caves, you got your water flowing down through. And so they kind of flush themselves out a little bit, especially Penn's Cave in Pennsylvania. Water flows in from a spring at the entrance, and it's 11 million gallons a day that pumps through that cave.
Wow.
And right out the other side. So, yeah, it carries a lot of it out. But in the hypogenic caves that don't have water coming down in, you know, that's one of the special things about the Caverns of Sonora and Carlsbad Caverns is they're some of the few hypogenically formed from solution rising up from below to dissolve out the cavities and make the caves. So those were hypogenically formed sulfuric acid caves. And so they don't have streams and creeks and rivers. So anything you shed in the cave, unless it gets removed by another caver, is going to become part of the cave, which is neat historically because you can see like the footprints of the original explorers in certain areas of the cave.
Wow. And those are not roped off, but maybe taped off.
Yeah. The Hall of the White Giant tour at Carlsbad Caverns is specifically a tour that the public can go on. It shut down during COVID and it's been reevaluated for its safety because it's a good caving tour, climbing and scrambling and whatnot. But on that section, you can see the footprints of the first explorers. And way older than that in other sections, of course, like there's areas where you can find giant sloth remains. There's a bunch of areas with giant sloth dung that's preserved in the caves.
Wow.
One time I was the chairman of the Pecos Valley Grotto, and I got Jim Goodbar to come do a talk, and he was talking about this ox skull that he found in a cave in Carlsbad Caverns. And the ox skull had rested in an area where a cave pool accumulated. And so like calcite crystals covered the horns and filled up the nostrils and the eye sockets. And so he's doing this talk for the Pecos Valley Grotto at NICRI, at the National Cave and Karst Research Institute. And he starts talking about that skull that he found. And he said it's in the Smithsonian Institute now on display. But then George Vinnie raises his hand and says, "It's on loan. It's right out there."
Oh.
Jim's like, "What?" And he like went out to the hallway where it was in a glass case. And it was like he was reuniting with an old friend. You know, So there's that crystal ox skull in a case. But then right next to it is a glass case of just a big pile of giant sloth dung that came out of one of the other caves in the area, too. That's one thing I love is how well things are preserved. There was a neat cave on Vancouver Island that an elk had fallen down in. It was like a 200-foot vertical entrance waterfall, and then beautiful big cave. It's called Glory Hole Cave is the name of it. But deep in that cave, there was an elk skeleton that stalactites were dripping from the antlers.
Oh, wow. Really? So cool to hear about like speleothems growing on remains or things like that.
It's amazing how fast they can grow because, you know, all these old show caves are starting to, the cave's like taking itself back. You can find flowstone that's growing over top of hand railings already. And it's pretty incredible how quickly it can grow sometimes.
All right. So we've been talking about Carlsbad and indeed you worked there as a guide and as a cave technician. What went into that?
About 5 years at Carlsbad, and I had five jobs at Carlsbad.
As you do.
We started there as park guides. I left Penn's Cave because I'm all like, I couldn't turn down working for Carlsbad Caverns National Park. So I moved my wife and daughter across the country for a seasonal gig, a GS5 seasonal park guide position. And I'm all like, what are the odds I'll get a permanent gig if we move the whole way across the country for this? And they're like, oh, probably. And then my season ended, nothing was open. So I was just stuck down in New Mexico trying to find work wherever I could. And then a GS4 park guide position permanent opened up. So I applied for that, was working that position. And then a GS5 opened, so eventually I'm working my way through that. But I was always going out with Aaron Lynch, you know, the cave specialist at Carlsbad. And I would go out on my days off and help with projects. It was an honor to get to go into the other caves in the park. You know, the park has 120 other caves as well. And so I was helping out as much as I could, and then they realized I was pretty good with ropes. So I was like helping to teach like cave rescue techniques and single rope technique workshops on a routine basis. And then their physical science technician position opened up, their cave tech. They weren't flying it yet on the government website. In fact, they just filled it like this month, but it's been vacant for a few years now. So I was doing it as a detail. I was still permanently employed as a park guide and filling in as a detail for the cave tech job. And so for that, you know, I was going out to the caves and doing radon monitoring. That was one of my collateral duties, checking on the caves, gates, checking on the condition of the caves, checking like humidity levels and carbon dioxide levels with sensors that were put in the caves. One neat aspect was getting to take researchers caving, like sometimes researchers would get permits to go into Carlsbad Caverns and collect water samples. So getting to team up with cave researchers, got to know, you know, Diana Northup. I got to join Derek Bristol on a fun trip once. He was climbing Liberty Dome. Liberty Dome was named because in 76, Ron Kerbo was the cave specialist, and he's one of my heroes. And Ron Kerbo saw a big hole in the ceiling, and there's two stories like this, but one of them was right above the bottomless pit. He's like, how can I get up there? I bet Tom Rahr could get up there. So he got a hold of Tom Rahr, legendary caver and rock climber of that area and of the planet. He's well known here at Yosemite because supposedly Rahr was the first person to rappel El Capitan formation here in Yosemite.
Yeah.
Supposedly he was the first person to rappel Half Dome here in Yosemite. And there's an old time rock climber here named John Dill. And every time he sees me, he's about Tom Rahr's age. And every time he sees me, he's like, hey, I got to get Rahr his anchors back. I still have some of his anchors. So I feel connected that, you know, I was caving in Tom areas down in the El Capitan formation of New Mexico, the limestone. And now I'm up here where Rahr also left his footprint. But Tom Rahr climbed this wall above the bottomless pit on 4th of July weekend of 1976. And he gets to the tippy top after 4 days of climbing to get to the top. And he had a bell in his pocket. And he pulled out the bell and he rang-a-lang-a-lang the bell from the top of that climb, echoing through the big room, and therefore naming it Liberty Dome. And he rigged up a rope, and Kerbo, you know, used his ascenders to get up there. And the story always went that they got up there and there was a small chamber and it dead-ended, and that was it. Well, decades went by, and they both started thinking that there was a tunnel up there that they missed, that they didn't push, a tunnel at the top that they didn't pursue. So Kerbo came to the park and said, you might want to recheck out Liberty Dome. And so Ron, our cave specialist at the time, got a hold of Derek Bristol and was like, we're going to recheck out Liberty Dome. Do you want to climb it for us? So Bristol came down on 4th of July weekend. This was 2019 and reclimbed Liberty Dome. And at that time, I wasn't set to go on the trip. I was working the entrance of the cave, just like telling people the rules. It was 4th of July weekend, so we had hundreds of people in line. I'm telling people, you know, don't spit in the cave, no gum, try to talk quietly, stay on the trails, don't touch the formations, things like that. And suddenly I see Derek Bristol with his crew nearby. So I like put up the little rope and I have to go say hi. I'm starstruck. And so I put up the little rope and I went over. I was like, hey, Mr. Bristol, nice to meet you. I'm Dave. He's like, yeah, you're with the Pecos Valley Grotto, right? I'm like, yeah, I hear you're going up Liberty Dome. I can't wait to see what you find up there. And he's like, well, why don't you just come with us? Okay, that'd be fantastic. He's like, all right, you good with rebelays? I'm like, yeah, I'm good with rebelays. He's like, all right, we'll see you at the bottomless pit at 5 o'clock.
It's a date.
And I went back to the hundreds of tourists that were waiting. And my shift was supposed to go till 7:30, but I'm like, I'm not missing out on joining Derek.
No, I'm calling in.
So I went to my supervisor and she's like, oh, we'll get your shift covered for that last few hours. And we met at the bottomless pit. We all climbed up the rope. It was like 255-foot rope climb with a rebelay at the top, dangling over top of the bottomless pit. So in total, it's like a 373-foot vertical exposure there.
Wow.
And he had rigged up, I think, two rebelays at the top. And the old stories were right, though. There was a small chamber. It dead-ended. So we did a survey of that area. We rappelled down. It was 4 a.m. by then. We called it a day. So then, you know, they went back to Tom Rahr and Kerbo and said, no, here's the map. It definitely dead ended up there. And both of them in separate conversations said, oh, must have been some other climb we did in there.
So now you got to find that one.
Yeah.
That's rad.
Of course, you know, Bristol's videos are on YouTube, so you can find, you just type in Liberty Dome.
Okay. Oh, so we put the Liberty Dome video up.
Yeah.
Okay, so then below that, is that where Bottomless Pit is again?
Yes, and of course the Bottomless Pit is obviously not bottomless. Jim White is credited for naming it. You know, he was the first major explorer of that cave, old-time cowboy, and he would throw rocks down pits to guesstimate the depth of the pits.
Sure.
And so he never heard anything when he threw rocks down that pit. So that's why he named it what he named it. He couldn't see the bottom. He couldn't hear things hitting the bottom. But now we know that the bottom of the bottomless pit is just really soft, silty sediment. So things that were being thrown down were just muffled by the soft, silty sediment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right along the main trail. So cowboys threw rocks down it. Visitors like to throw water bottles down it and coins and other random things. So yeah, that was one of the fun collateral duties of being a cave tech, just cleaning up pits, rappelling down pits in the big room and just gathering up stuff that was thrown down them. So we would do the bottomless pit typically like once a year, and we'd always find probably like $50 just of coins, junior ranger books and water bottles and whatnot. One time I was going down there with Erin Lynch, and she starts doing this traverse along the wall of the pit. And we're like, I wonder what she's going for. And we see her reach for something, and she comes back, and then she starts coming up the ascenders, and she's got a bra in her hand. A bra out of the bottomless pit. So I sometimes refer to it as the bottomless pit nowadays because of that.
I was going to be, my question is, what are some of the more interesting things you found? I guess that's it then, huh?
That was one of them.
All right. But at around this same time when you're at Carlsbad, your wife gets a cave job too.
Mm. Yeah, she was majoring in geology when we moved to Carlsbad. So she was finishing up her degree with an online program and, you know, raising our kiddo who was only 1.5 at the time. As we were pulling into Carlsbad, New Mexico to move there for my park guide job, we passed the BLM office, the Bureau of Land Management. And she just off the cuff says, maybe I'll work there someday. Sure enough, as she was finishing up her geology degree, like a student internship opened up at the BLM office there, and she got it. And then, you know, we were there for over 5 years. So time goes on and she ends up becoming an environmental protection specialist there. And then they realized her dramatic background with caves and caving. So they made her designated the cave and karst environmental protection specialist. And she was mainly focusing a lot on the gypsum basin. Because, you know, the Guadalupe Mountains are a Permian limestone reef that encompassed around an inland sea, the Delaware Sea. And when that sea evaporated, it filled up that basin with salts and gypsums. The salts made the Salado Formation, and the gypsums made the Castile Formation. And between the two of those, that's actually the longest continuous formation of evaporites in the world. So there's loads of caves in their area. The BLM manages a lot of nice limestone caves too, but they've got probably thousands of gypsum caves, including many people know Parks Ranch Cave. That's one that's sort of they allow people to go in and go explore. So there's a little campground at it. I believe that's the second longest gypsum cave in the Western Hemisphere. But Melissa would do karst surveys and she would monitor industry. She was watching over the gas and oil industry to try to make sure they weren't damaging the caves as much as possible. So she would go out and do site inspections and check for leaks and make sure that things were away from sinkholes and drainages and grikes and swallets. And yeah, so we would get calls from time to time like, hey, can you come check this out? And I'd go with her usually on my days off and help with karst surveys and whatnot. And so one time she got this call saying, we think we found a cave. And they were laying down a pipe and they accidentally tapped into the roof of a gypsum cave that didn't have an entrance yet. So they accidentally made an entrance to this cave. And they're like, can you come out and tell us? And so she went out there and she's like, yeah, that's a cave. You're going to have to move your operation. So they just like roped it off, caution tape, and moved it out of the way. But we need to know which direction that cave was going. So we were just going to go survey the first chamber of it. So we went the next weekend, anchored it off, and I rappelled down in. But we had Rose with us. with, you know, this was off the clock. So we had our daughter with us. She was 5 at the time. And she was really good with ropes. I would always belay her. But she always would help us to train the park guides at Carlsbad. Like, she would teach them knots and teach them about rappel devices and ascenders.
Wow.
So we hooked her up in her rappel device, and Melissa was belaying her from the top, and I was spotting her as she came down in. So, yeah, she always likes to talk to her classmates about the time she got – she always says she was the first one to rappel into a cave, a virgin cave. I went down first to check for hazards. So she was on the first trip. She was the second one to enter that one. So that's a fun story for her.
Yeah. But you can let her have that.
Yeah,
she was the first.
First trip. Second cave was just as good as first.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got to know – I've heard about this thing that you did with the FBI, and everyone's like, you got to ask Dave about the FBI and it's something to do with explosives. I'll let you tell what this whole thing is.
So when I was at Carlsbad, and I, you know, I did that detail as the cave tech, and I thought that that was my dream job, and who knows, maybe it is, maybe it was, but it wasn't flying on USA jobs. So I'm like, I gotta do something else. And a safety position opened up, safety specialist position at Carlsbad. And I'm like, if I'm safety guy, I can go caving all the time. There was other reasons I wanted to get into it, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, let's be real.
That was a great perk.
Sure.
I could go on caving trips as the safety specialist for the park. So I'd already done a lot of safety trainings, but I amped up my safety experience and I got the job. After about 5 months of being in that position, this call went out nationwide, National Park Service, like, safety message. And it's like, everyone needs to assess their historical archive because parks are finding unexploded ordnances here, there, and everywhere. Like, there were historical parks that, like, had things in the basement that were still live in their historic archives. There was... people were accidentally, like, using museum exhibits that were, like, live cannonballs from World Wars and things like that. So I just said, hey, we got to look at all of our historic stuff, and we have to fill out this inventory and send it back to Region, and then they'll send it off to Washington. And so I started going down through the list, and a lot of folks were like, oh, we don't have that stuff. We don't have this or that. I'm like, yeah, but we still have to check. We have to physically go. We have to physically check. So we went to the historical archives building, and I see a cabinet that just says the word metal on it. I'm like, well, I'm going to start there. So I go to the metal cabinet, and I open up, and there's some old guns in it. There's some old bullets.
Okay.
You know, we find these in the cave from time to time. You'd be walking through Carlsbad Caverns, and you'd find bullet shells from old cowboys doing crazy stuff down there. 100 years ago, the old guano miners. Then I put out another shelf, and there's just all these containers that say blasting caps on them. And Rod Hertz was the cave specialist at that point in time. He's like, oh yeah, I guess we should report those things. You know, there's a bunch of those in Ogle Cave. I was like, well, we have to document that. He's like, I don't know how many there are. There's probably a good amount in there.
Ogle Cave is just this historically known cave entrance where things happened.
Yes, it was used for guano mining, especially after they stopped guano mining in the main cave of Carlsbad. And Ogle Cave is a tucked away cave in the backcountry, and they used to do, like, ranger guided high adventure caving tours there, like by permit. And once White Nose hit, they stopped because Ogle Cave is, as far as I know, the largest hibernacula in the park. It's actually a cave that bats hibernate in. You know, everyone goes there for the maternity colony of free-tailed bats that are in the bat cave of Carlsbad. I have a fun story about them too, but everyone goes to see them, but they don't hibernate there. They migrate south for the winter. But we do have, there's 17 species of bat in that park. And so some of them are hibernating bats. And so Ogle Cave is where some of them hibernate, but the ceiling is, like, in some areas, it's like 250 feet in the air. And so we'd go and try to do bat counts, but you're just lying on your back trying to spot these little brown cotton balls 250 feet in the air.
Wow.
So I moved away because Yosemite was calling. We moved to Yosemite for professional development and whatnot. My wife got a job here. I get a call from the New Mexico State Police Bomb Squad. And they said, we were talking with the chief of law enforcement at Carlsbad. And they said that there's some potential explosives in this one cave. Can you tell me about this cave? So I describe it to them. And he's like, all right, this sounds kind of technical. We'll get a hold of you later. A week goes by and I get a phone call from the ATF. And the ATF says, tell me about this cave that there might be explosives in. So I describe it with the rappelling. It's like a 185-foot vertical pit at the entrance of Ogle. So he's like, so pretty much a 200-foot vertical pit you got to rappel down just to get into the cave. And I'm like, yep. He's like, all right, we'll get in touch with you soon. So a week later, I get a call from the FBI, like the lead ropes rescue guy from the FBI. He's like, tell me about this cave. So I go into great detail describing everything that would be involved to go in and out of Ogle Cave. And he's like, all right, we're going to want you to just come down to New Mexico and run this operation with us.
All right.
Okay. And by this point, I'd been feeling out of shape. I moved to Yosemite. I hadn't been caving. I hadn't been on the rope. So I'm like, I'm supposed to go team up with the FBI for this caving op. So I'm just like putting ropes in my trees and trying to, you know, climb as much as I can to get a little bit back in my caving shape. And he's like, you got 2 weeks. So I flew down to New Mexico and met up with the team. And day one, we just went to the cave entrance to show them the entrance, to rig up a haul line and rig up the belay line and the rappel line. And they wanted to test their radio equipment. But the superintendent wouldn't sign off on like a trip to go into the cave yet because they weren't going in on that day, just rigging it up. So I rappelled down, put in the rope protection and whatnot, and they wanted me to just test their radios. They're like, go into the cave just a little bit. So I went in a little bit into the twilight zone, and they're like, see, our radios work perfectly fine. I'm like, yeah, but I don't think they're going to work once we get deeper in. They're like, nah, we're the FBI. These things will work just fine. And I climb up out, and we call it a day. And day two was just ropes practice. We go to a fire tower. And that's when I meet like the whole gang. There was like 20 people there, New Mexico State Police Bomb Squad, the ATF, and FBI crew. And they're like, all right, Dave, you're going to take in this group of seven to assess the situation, and then you'll take them out, and then you're going to take in this group of six to deal with the situation. And I'm like, we're not going to have enough time to do all that. I'm like, just the climb out. If you're a good climber can do it in 10 minutes. I'm a little slow. I take sometimes 15 minutes to climb out. And so if I'm taking 12 of you in, and if you're not as good of climbers, they're like, we're fine climbers. Don't you worry about that. So we get to the fire tower and they're rappelling down the fire tower and they're really, really good at it. I'm like, yeah, but we have to get back up. So let's work on ascending. And they were using, gree-grees as their ascending device. You familiar with gree-grees, Matt?
But describe them. They're belay devices, right?
Yeah, but you can use it as a rappel device too. You can just rappel down on a gree-gree.
Yeah.
And so the reason they liked that is because they could rappel down on a gree-gree, and then they could just slap an ascender with a foot loop on above them, and then they could just step up in the foot loop and pull the rope through their gree-gree. So they were treating that device as an all-functioning device, a descending device and an ascending device, so that they didn't have to practice changeovers.
Okay. So it was like their basic or their crawl or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they could just rappel back and forth. They could go up with it. They could go down with it.
That doesn't quite seem right.
It's a neat idea, but it's not very efficient.
I guess not. And
so they were taking like 20 minutes, most of them, to climb the 50-foot tower. And some of them were starting to get tired with that motion that they had to do. And I'm like, guys, this cave pit's like four times that height. And so if you take 20 minutes for this, You know, that's almost an hour per caver. That's 12 hours just to do the climb out for one. So eventually they started realizing it wasn't going to work. And the FBI guy came up to me. He's like, what do you think? I'm like, I think that we need as small team as possible. Just me and maybe three other guys. He's like, all right, Dave, whatever you say. So the day came, and of course it was the one day it snowed that day. It was freezing cold. The next day was like 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
Of course.
The day that we went to the cave, it was snowing. And they had all this heavy equipment to carry up, like things that would x-ray the boxes and whatnot. And so we get to the cave, and I clip in, and I start backing up to rappel in. And the one guy from the ATF just starts motioning that he's not going down. He sees me going. He's like, I'm out. So it just came down to me, the lead FBI guy, the lead New Mexico State Police guy, and the lead ATF guy. And so we rappelled down in, and then they came in, and I was taking them through the cave, and I was focusing on cave conservation, saying, watch out for this, watch out for that. So then they started really getting into it, like, what's this crystal, Dave? And, whoa, look, there's a fossilized bat over there. So it was a good bonding experience, but we found the blasting caps, which I was worried about because I wasn't entirely sure where they were located. I had an idea, and I reached out to as many cavers that had been in Ogle as I could to find out where they were at. We located them, and they x-rayed them and decided to remove them from the cave in like this container that would house any accidental explosion. And the whole thing took from before sunrise till after sunset for that small of a group. And when we get to the entrance, they were tired. And the ATF guy, he was out of the group, the weakest on rope. So we were like, let's send him up first so we can get him out of the cave. And he was getting cold too. And he took about a half an hour to get halfway up. So the ropes rescue guy that was on the surface made a call to rig up a haul system and haul him out of the cave. And since the haul system was already rigged, they decided to haul all of them out of the cave, which they were pretty bummed about because the New Mexico State Police guy was like, I can do this climb. I know I can. And then he's being hauled up out, just sitting there with this look on his face like he was defeated.
Aww.
But the haul took a while too. It took like 45 minutes per person to haul them out. And they're like, all right, Dave. And they radioed down to me like, you want to haul it out too? I'm like, no, thank you. So I just clipped on my ascenders and shimmied up in about 11 minutes and out of the cave. And it was a good time. We got the potential explosives out of the cave. And because they were nervous that if we left them in place, someone would see them down the road and be like, oh, the FBI checked this out back in 2022. They were nervous that they would find other explosives in the cave and assume that they were safe and checked. So they removed them from the cave. But we're friends to this day. The FBI guy still text messages me. He actually got a little team and flew down to Yosemite about a year ago to like do a little awards ceremony, like requested the superintendent, and they presented me this fun little,
there it is.
Letter signed by the director of the FBI. Yeah.
How about that?
Operation Ogle. You can Google it.
Wow. Okay. That's so fun. Macho dudes ain't got nothing on cavers.
Oh, they took me out to dinner every night. They're like, we didn't know what we were getting into, Dave.
Oh, man. Okay. So then, well, not then, because Yosemite was, you know, at this time, but as a Yosemite person now, you're not doing as much caving.
I wish I could. I'm the safety specialist for Yosemite. So at Yosemite, I'm known as Caver Dave because like I give all the employees their like welcome to the park safety talk. And then I give them safety trainings on, you know, fall protection and respirators, which are all cave related stuff. So
yeah.
I have a lot of experience with all that and teach them about bloodborne pathogens and CPR. But then all my stories are about caves. Like one time I was responding to a medical condition in a cave. And so I'm widely known as Caver Dave at Yosemite. So I'm trying to go caving as much as I can. We got some in the park. We got some Talus caves. There's a special cave scorpion in the park. Like, I believe it's called the Yosemite Scorpion. It was Jean Krechka, if I'm pronouncing her name right, that studied it. So we got some marble in the park, in the backcountry, because there was a vein of marble that's older than the granite. So we do have a couple little marble caves.
Wow, okay.
Called the Calaveras Formation. But then just east of the park, that marble formation pops out of the ground, and there's a bunch of pretty nice marble caves in that area. So, yeah, I get up there as much as I can. I'm thankful I found some of the local cavers, like Matt Bowers has been wonderful taking me around. Dave Bunnell, that was an honor getting to go caving with Mr. Bunnell. Perfect timing because he just moved. So I would have been a little depressed if I didn't get to go on a trip with Mr. Bunnell before he took off. Greg Stock, you know, he's the geologist for Yosemite, and he's a great caver. So I've been super thankful for the cavers I have connected with here.
You're running a program, too, with the NSS, like a speaker series or something like that?
Yeah, it's a play on words. Instead of, you know, speleologist, you are a guest in the classroom or at the facility, educational facility, or just out at a carnival. So Spelio Guest
is
the name of it. So, yeah, Devra, I'm sure many of you know Devra that runs the education branch. She asked me about that. So that's one way I've been staying tied to my caving roots, is like zooming into classrooms all over the country and giving them cave talks as much as I can. And like next week, I'm doing a cave talk for the Yosemite Mountain Climbers Association. But we're trying to build the program. So if there's any cavers out there that are also, you know, educators or public speakers that would be interested in being a Spelio guest, let me know, because, you know, we'll get calls from random parts of the country and they're like, we're hoping to have an in-person talk in Massachusetts. And so then I have to track down a grotto in Massachusetts and try to find someone that's willing to do a cave talk there. And so, yeah, that's a fun volunteer project.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. All right. Well, so yeah, if you're listening, you got a presentation or something, hit you up, I guess, huh?
Yeah. A lot of it's just folks looking for basic caving information. They want to hear about stalactites and stalagmites and bats. Since I was a teacher, that really comes in handy. And since I was a cave guide at Penn's Cave, I did a tour on the hour, every hour for like a decade. And it averaged out to about 1,000 tours a year. So just that one cave, I did like 10,000 cave tours. And then
Carlsbad
and Sonora and Horn Lake on top. So yeah, I like talking to the public about caves. And then you come up with a lot of like cave jokes and memory methods and puns. And in fact, right here, Carlsbad gave me a pun trophy. It's called the Pandemic Award in 2020.
The Pandemic Award.
Worst cave puns.
You can rattle off a cave for every state, at least? At least one?
Well, I did that for safety. I had to learn that for safety, and here's why. Because at Carlsbad, with those elevator lines, you would get like sometimes a two-hour, sometimes a three-hour elevator line to get out of the cave.
Oh, my gosh.
People were getting hostile. So I just had to be good at talking to the public about caves. So I would try to have one for every state so I could just be like, where are you folks from? Oh, you're from Massachusetts, home to King Philip's Cave. That's the one I like to say for Massachusetts, because I try to think of a cave that if the public went to, it wouldn't be a big deal, because it's like one that has a sign or a gate and it's already managed by an organization. I'd like to say Pettibone Falls Cave from Massachusetts. I never knew if I was pronouncing that one right, because I've read it, but I've never heard anyone else say it. But that was, you know, the cave where the NSS was started. That's where the NSS Constitution was ratified, in that cave in Massachusetts.
Did not know that.
But I always go with King Philip's Cave because it's a fun one. It's got a neat historical story behind it. But yeah, trying to razzle-dazzle the public was always fun.
What about Indiana? What's your
Indiana Caverns.
Indiana Caverns.
Yeah, that's a great one because, you know, they got boat tours in it, Southern Indiana. So that's the one I really like when I think of Indiana, because it's got, you know, fossils from the Pleistocene, like these Ice Age animals, like I believe one of the largest collections of Ice Age animals of any cave in at least the country.
Yeah.
In Indiana caverns.
We just talked about it on the Rand Hazlett episode. So that's super rad. And
you know the name Trey Hanke? He was working in the Indiana caves for a while.
Yeah.
He was a Pennsylvania caver too. I worked at Penn's Cave and he worked at Laurel Caverns down by Pittsburgh originally.
Yeah, he was a guest on the podcast. Great guy.
Oh, was he? I'll have to check that one out.
He was my October guest.
Yeah, Laurel Caverns is one of the fun things about it was it has the world's largest man-made artificial cave. At least it was. I don't know if it still is. But the guy that was running the cave, he wanted to have a cave exhibit that people could go through in wheelchairs because Laurel Caverns wasn't very capable for people that weren't able to get around as easy. So he built an artificial cave so that people could go through with wheelchairs. But he made it so elaborate that he was sinking all this money to it. And he's all like, how am I ever going to see return on this thing? So he made it a mini golf course, a putt-putt mini golf. So one thing about Laurel Caverns.
Yeah.
Okay,
so let me come full circle on the Yosemite question and ask you what you think, because you mentioned crowds at Carlsbad and the waits to get on the elevators to get out. What would you say is a good time of year to visit Carlsbad when it's not too crowded?
Well, honestly, I would say anytime, as long as you're willing to hike out of the cave.
Okay. All right. So if you're willing to walk out, you can just walk out and not wait in line at the elevator.
Right. There was a time period where they weren't allowing that during COVID because they didn't want people passing each other in that narrow aisle.
Sure.
But generally, you can just hike out. And I would often encourage people hike in, see the big room and hike out. But if you didn't have all day, you know, take the elevator down, see the big room and then hike out. But then you're doing the audio guide in reverse for the hike out. Definitely do the audio guide. It's got some neat information on it. I would go there, not every weekend with my daughter, but many days off, I would just take my daughter there and we just do the audio guide and wander through that thing. She knows that cave pretty well from when she was 3 years old going through it. One fun story was she would help me with, I mentioned the training of the guides, but then she started helping me with like public speaking engagements. And a fun one was the bat flight talk, because you'd go there before sunset and you'd talk about bats until the bats choose to fly out of the cave, if they choose to fly out. So sometimes you're talking for 30 seconds and then the bats come out. Tornado of bats for sometimes 3 hours continuously rising out of that magical cave. But then sometimes you'd start talking about bats and an hour later, there's still no bats. So some guides would be like, all right, I'm going to stop talking now. But I'm like, I'm going to keep talking until these bats come out.
Let's vamp.
Sometimes it was like 2 hours. The longest I ever did was 2.5.
Just talking about bats.
And so I'd cheat and use my daughter as a placement in the crowd. And I'd be talking about the mother bats and how they come there to have their babies. They arrive from Mexico pregnant and they go to the maternity roost and have their babies in the nursery. And when a mother bat gives birth to a baby bat, it's a big bat relative to her size, up to like a third of her body mass. So I would compare that to humans. You know, I'd be like, that's like a small human giving birth to like a 30-pound child, like a toddler.
Wow.
So I'd be like, are there any toddlers in the audience? And my wife would like raise her hand. Melissa would like point at our kiddo sitting next to her. And I'd walk up and like, ma'am, can I borrow your child? And she'd be like, sure. So she would hand me Rose and I would walk down to the front and the people were like, what's he doing? Just carrying this random kid around. So I'd just be carrying around talking about bats. And then I'd be like, what about you, Junior Ranger? Do you like bats? And I just start asking her very simple questions. Like, do you think bats are good or bad? What do bats eat? And she'd be like, bugs. Well, these bats prefer moths. And then her answers would get more complex. And then next thing you know,
the slow reveal.
And she's holding the microphone and she's like, That's come from the order Coraptera, which is Greek for hand wing, because they have four fingers and a thumb. And the crowd is just like, what is happening? That's a fond memory.
Oh, I love that so much. How old is Rose now?
She's 8.
Oh, so this has been a while.
Yeah, we've been here for 2 years now. And then during COVID, you know, we weren't doing bat flight programs.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's out of the swing of things with giving cave tours, but we're still trying to get underground as much as we can. We took her to, of course, all the show caves in the area, Moaning Caverns, Mercer Caverns, California Caverns, Black Chasm Caverns. And then there's a really neat Bureau of Reclamation cave not far from here that you can swim through, Natural Bridge Cave. Not to be confused, of course, with Natural Bridge Caverns in Texas and the other Natural Bridge Caves. There's one out your way, right, in like Virginia, that George Washington owned, I think, Natural Bridge Cave.
I'm not familiar. And
Thomas Jefferson owned it, but there's initials that say GW in the cave that are believed to be George Washington. But that's a wild cave that's advertised to the public here, Natural Bridge Cave in Sonora, California, that you can actually like float through. Dave Bunnell's got some beautiful photos of that. So we go to that one pretty often.
So you've done the cave ballad a few times. You've submitted cave ballads, which has always been kind of this, I don't know, to me, like this fun little aside that the NSS does where they'll judge cave songs, essentially.
Yes, and it is. I'm a musician, and it was sort of a career for a while. My brother and I would play in bands on the weekends, and I taught drum lessons at a high school and whatnot. So when I was working at the cave park in Canada, you had to live in a tent when you were working there. You lived there. So, well, some of the people had some pretty elaborate camp stuff. I was just some Pennsylvania kid that didn't know much about living in the forest. So I just had a regular tent. So I'm there alone throughout the winters. And that's how I'd bide my time, was just writing cave songs. So I took MC Hammer's You Can't Touch This and made it about caves because you're not supposed to touch calcite.
Okay. All right.
I took On the Road Again and made it On Rope Again.
Oh, yes.
And we did a bunch. I'm not doing it as much now because my career with Yosemite is pretty busy, but also because I'm not around my brother. Me and my brother always loved – he's a great Pennsylvania caver, Danny Broombaugh with the Nittany Grotto. And he's a phenomenal musician. So that's where it all started. But Melissa beat me 2 years ago. She got the blue ribbon with one of her songs that she did about the Guads. And yeah, now that she's submitting songs, I don't win as much anymore.
a little family rivalry. Nice. Dave, this was such a great talk. I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for all that you have done and continue to do in the world of caving. And I just hope you get to go caving a little more often moving forward. Sounds like it's been a bit of a drought the last couple of years.
Yeah, just the last year and a half, really. I've been, like I said, thankful to the California cavers. I got to go up to lava beds and do some surveying of some of their ice deposits there with Matt Bowers. So that was special. Go cave with Dave Bunnell. That was really great. So I'm starting to get into the Western caving. So if there's any Western cavers out there looking for a caving buddy, let me know. You can hit me up on Instagram, Caver Dave. That's my handle on Instagram.
There you go. Caver Dave on Instagram. Dave, how much fun was this, man? Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure, Matt.
Wow, wasn't that FBI story something? Dave, you are a treasure. And since you work for the National Park Service, I can say you're a national treasure. Thank you so much, Dave. What a wonderful conversation. It was so fun for me to revisit it, too. He and I talked back in, like, December, and to work on the edit this past week was such a joy. It's like I get to have the conversation all over again. Hope you enjoyed it, too. Support this podcast by supporting caving. Donate to the NSS. Donate to your grotto. Donate to your local Karst Conservancy. Or support the sponsors of this podcast, past and present. Currently, it's Sophie Reaptress. Get a cave suit at sophiereaptress.com. But also, we've been supported in the past by Swago, swagogear.com. Get that nice, shiny, waterproof cave pack. Organic Robot Designs, T-shirt shop in Greenfield, Indiana. If your grotto needs some fundraising, sell some T-shirts. Get a design together, send it over to Charlie, or he can help you with the design. OrganicRobotDesigns.com. Also, El Spilio lights, currently being sold by On Rope One. Let me see, is that... next month. Next month. Another Indiana guy. And he's big in Indiana right now. Mike Drake. Mike Drake, who just made the longest cave in Indiana's famous Garrison Chapel Valley a little bit longer, or a good bit longer, by connecting Studebaker Pit to Wayne Cave. And I couldn't wait to talk to Mike about it. He is on next month. An in-person guest. He was sitting right there. I'm pointing at my chair here in the office. Can't wait for you to hear that on April 1st. My name is Matt Pelzer from the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.